Having emerged from the underworld, the people were settled in this little place here. And in the four directions are the mountains of the four directions, filled with the seeds of all things. This is the house of Changing Woman, a wonderful figure in the Navajo mythology. She was born miraculously of a cloud. And she became the mother then of these boys by miracle, by virgin birth. She was bathing at a little spring, and the sun shone upon her. And when she came home, she gave birth to a little boy. There were monsters troubling the neighborhood, and so she dug a little hole and put the boy down there in a kind of under earth cradle to protect her from the monsters, and then went back to the spring to wash herself, and she conceived again, this time of the moon. And so she comes back, and here are her two little boys. The boy who was born of the sun is called Killer of Enemies. And here's the way he appears in the dance rituals. He is the warrior, outward directed. The boy who was born of the moon is called Child of the Water. And he is the medicine man, the shaman. The twinned hero motif is common to many, many mythologies of the world. And they represent the warrior chieftain and his magician priest. Well, they're living with their mother, and they see that not only their mother, but the whole neighborhood is being troubled by monsters. And so they think they had better go and get help from their father, the sun. The sun is ultimately the father of them both, because the sunlight's the light of the moon, so forth and so on, to help their mother. Now, their mother had told them, it's dangerous around here, boys, and you can go to the east, to the south, to the west, but don't go north. So they go north. That's the only way to get new material. Don't obey the community. They're the ones that are stuck or in trouble. So they are guided by Rainbow Man. They go to the mountains of the four quarters. Everything in the American Indian things is in fours. They circumambulate the world and are on their way. Now, this is a typical hero quest myth. When they come to the end of the known world, that is, say, when they reach the horizon, they are confronted by this threshold guardian, whose name is White Sands Boy. He is the guardian at the east. He has long arms. He seizes people and buries their head in the sand and so smothers them. He is the one who sees to it that people don't go beyond the bounds of the mythology. The boys give him praise. They say, oh, wonderful White Sands Boy, there never was a thing in the world like you. And he'd never received such praise in his life. And so he said, okay, you can go on. And they make the round. There's White Sands Boy and Blue Sands Boy and so forth and so forth. And now they are beyond the bounds of the world. They're going along in a kind of featureless landscape. And they see an old, old woman. And her name is Old Age. And she says, oh, hello, boys. What are you doing way out here, you earth people? They say, we're on the way to our father's house, the sun, to get weapons to save our mother from the monsters. Oh, she says, that's a long, long way. You'll be old when you get there. But she said, I'll give you some advice. Don't walk on my path. Walk to the right of it. So the boys start walking along to the right, but then they forget. I know the heroes always forget. And they are walking on the path again. And they begin to feel old. And they have to pick up sticks and walk with these. And then finally they can't walk at all. And the old woman has been watching them. She comes and says, I told you. Well, they said, can't you make us young again? Or she said, if you'll be careful now, I'll do that. And so she spit on her hand and took moisture from under her armpits and from between her legs, and she rubs it over them, and they're made young again. And she said, now you stay on the right of the path. So they go along, and pretty soon they see another little old lady, black little old lady. Who's this? This is Spider Woman. Now, these spiders live in the ground, and this is kind of fairy godmother, the counterpart of the fairy godmother. She's the spirit of the earth mother itself, in the form of the old spider. And again, oh, hello, earth boys. What brings you out here? Oh, we're on the way to our father, the sun, to get weapons to save our mother. Oh, that's a long, long trip. You better come down into my little house, and I'll fix you up for that journey. And so she made the sun go fast. She has power over the sun itself, so that it should set, and they'd have to spend the whole night with her. They thought it was a very little hole. How can we fit through that? But when it came time, there's no problem at all. They go down, and she feeds them certain food, and gives them certain pieces of ebony and lapis lazuli or turquoise to swallow, and fixes them up for the journey, and tells them what the problems are going to be that they're going to meet, and she gives them a feather to protect them. Now, here's the feather off here that little old spider woman gave the two boys. She says, hold this feather close, and you'll get through all obstacles. Now, here are the obstacles. The cactus that cut and the reeds that pierce, and the rocks that clash together. Well, with these to help, the boys start on their path, and they do pass through these obstacles. Standard stuff. We've gone past the known world. Magical help comes to us in the form of some of the fairy mother godmother. Ways of the journey are predicted and overcome. The boys then come to the ocean that surrounds the world. That's a standard mythological motif. Okeanos of the Greeks and so forth and so on. We know that it surrounds the world because here are the four mountains of the four directions. In other words, they have translated a space into a flat picture. By the way, I might point out, in these pictures, the animals are not rendered naturalistically. These people know how to render all these things naturalistically. They're rendered in the form of their spiritual reference. The transformation of nature in art is rendering the nature phenomenon transparent to transcendence. The boys now cross the water with the feather between them by the magic power that has been given them. Then they're approaching the house of the sun. And this is guarded by four types of animal guardian. First, we have the serpents, the four serpents. The young man who is being trained to be a warrior, having his psychology transformed from that of secular to military consciousness, comes walking in along this line, kneels down here with his head over this basket of yucca suds. He undergoes a ceremonial washing, a purification. Purification before you have the revelation, and that's the sense of this rite. These then are the guardian bears, these are the guardian thunderbirds, and these are the guardian winds. The boys, having passed these, come to the house of the sun. Now, here's the sun's house. It's a microcosm of the macrocosm, but the four directions. Here is the sun's daughter. Here is the sun's horse. He rides around the world with his sun's shield. These are the steps of the boys and pauses where they meet the obstacles on the way. They arrive, the sun is off on his daily trip, and the boys are met by the sun's daughter. She says, who are you? And they say, we're the sons of the sun. Oh, you are you? Huh. So she says, well, Daddy's not home now, but when he comes home, he's going to make it tough for you. So I'll protect you. And she wraps them in clouds of the four colors and stores them over the doors of their proper color. So in the evening, the sun arrives. He gets off his horse. He comes into the house. He hangs his shield on the wall, and it goes clunk, 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 clunk. And he turns to his wife and says, who are those two young men I saw coming in here today? She says, you've always told me you behave yourself when you go around the world. These boys say they're your sons. Oh, they do, do they? So he searches the house, and by gosh, he pulls them down. And then he submits them to tests. This is a favorite motif in American Indian stories. The father test, or the father-in-law test or whatnot. He throws them against spikes of the four colors in the four directions, flint spikes. They hang onto the feather, two boys, one feather. Don't worry, this is myth. They survive. He gives them poison tobacco to smoke. They survive. He puts them in a sweat lodge and tries to sweat them to death. They survive. He finally says, well, I guess you are my sons. Come into the next room. So he takes them into the next room. He stands one of the boys on a black buffalo skin, the other on a white, and he tells them their true names, and each acquires his own true character. You remember before they were both black and the same size. Now they're taller, and the water is blue. Well, the description of that moment of initiation in that room where the thunders come in and lightnings come in, and wow, it's something terrific. But now they know who they are. This is the second birth through the Father. The same thing we've been talking about. And when they have survived that, they are so powerful, they split into four. And now in full power, they start back across the cosmic ocean. They come to the hole in the sky. Now the feather that they're riding on here is not the one that Spider-Woman gave them, it's the one their father has given them. Their father now at the hole in the sky gives them a final examination. What's your name? What's the name of the northern mountain? What's the name of the hole in the earth? And all this kind of thing. And the answers are whispered to them by Big Fly and Little Wind. Now you may say this is cheating, but it isn't cheating. If they weren't worthy of this, they would not have received the inspiration. So there you are. If you're meant to pass the exam, you'll pass. So having passed the exam, they come down to the central mountain, Mount Taylor, and there you see their footprints landing on the mountain. Now, before they go to work to kill the specific monsters that are troubling their mother, they have to kill the archetypal monster. And he lives here by this lake. And his name is Big Lonesome Monster. Now, the characteristic of monsters is that they mistake shadow for substance. And so this big, lonesome monster sees the two boys reflected in the lake. Oh, he thinks, I can drink them up and digest them to death. So the big, lonesome monster, mistaking shadow for substance, drinks up the lake and digests hard, and then spits it out again, and by gosh, there they are. He drinks up the lake four times. Now, even a monster is worn out after that performance, and so the boys move in. Now, interestingly, this monster is also a son of the sun. But the sun moves in to help the boys kill the monster. You've got this ambiguity about virtue and vice and pairs of opposites and all that. So the monster is killed. And now they're ready to go home. When they come past the foot of Mount Taylor, they trip, and their father weapons are gone. They have moved from the realm of sheer male fire into the mixed realm of water, where the fire is mingled with earth. And so they are met by Talking God, who is the male ancestor of the female line of the gods. He is mixed of male and female, and he gives them a talking prayer stick to guide them that is made of male and female corn. They're given double weapons here now, male and female weapons. And this energy coming from them in the form of flints indicates that they're filled with magic power and they're still riding on the feather. Now, just to show you this very interesting god, Talking God. His mouth and eyes are made of masculine rain and female mist coming up in this form. His nose is of a corn stalk. He has given them the weapons to kill the earthly monsters. And after a terrific series of battles killing these tremendous monsters, the boys are nearly wiped out. They're so worn out. They've lost their arms and legs, and Child of the Water is in danger of just becoming the reflection of killer of enemies. And so the gods come down and enact a ceremony over them, and they're given health again. And what do you suppose the ceremony is? It's the one I've just told you, the ceremony of their own life story. Just as the psychoanalyst leads you back to remember all those things of childhood and you put you on your proper path again, so they. And when they have passed this test and gone through this ceremony, they are again four. And this is the strongest sand painting of the lot, the four boys, each standing on the mountain of his own color. Now, when Mordokes had received the ceremony from Jeff King, he had omitted this picture. And when he had finished, he said, well, that's it. Mord said, no, Jeff, there must be another picture. Now, she knew enough to know what was required in a mythological ceremonial situation. No, he said, I've given you everything. No, Jeff, she said. Okay, he said, I'll give it to you. So we got the whole story here. This is a typical mythological adventure, leaving the bounded world in which you have been brought up, going beyond all that anybody knows into domains of transcendence, and then acquiring what is missing and coming back with the boon. Perfectly beautiful example of this system. Now, this is a painting that was made by a friend of Black Elk. You know John Neihardt's book, Black Elk Speaks. It's a beautiful book. Fortunately, it was a poet who received this message from old Black Elk, who was in his 90s, of the vision that this guardian of the Oglala's medicine pipe had experienced when he was a boy of nine, a vision that foretold in a magical way, really, the destiny before his people. Came to him long before they had had their first encounters with the cavalry and the Battle of Wounded Knee and all that. Old Black Elk, when he was quite a youngster, 14 or so, participated in the battle with Custer. At one point in his vision, he said, I saw myself on the sacred central mountain of the world. And here he is on the central mountain of the world with the axial tree and the three birds round about, and Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John round about as well. And he said, the central mountain of the world, the highest mountain, is Horny Peak in South Dakota. And immediately after that, he said, but the central mountain is everywhere. Now, there's a man that knew the difference between the folk cultic symbol and the reference of the symbol. The holy land is everywhere. And so when you come into a landscape for the purpose of the cult and worship, so that you can address your mind to the mystery, designate this is the center, this is the north, this is the south mountain, and so forth. This word of this wise old man reminds me of a sentence, comes from a text of the 12th century, that was translated from Greek into Latin, called the Book of the 24 Philosophers. It says there, God is an intelligible sphere. Intelligible means known to the mind. An intelligible sphere whose center is everywhere and circumference nowhere. And so it's right here. And the function of the ritual and the myth is to let you experience it here, not somewhere else a long time ago. I would say that there's no conflict between mysticism, the mystical dimension and its realization, and science. But there is a difference between the science of 2000 BC and the science of 2000 AD. And we're in trouble on it because we have a sacred text that was composed somewhere else by another people a long time ago and has nothing to do with the experience of our lives. And so there's a fundamental disengagement. And besides, when we look back at that text, it is a text that speaks of man as superior to nature, man's mastery over nature as being what has been given to him, and just compare that with the words of Black Elk. This is the difference between mythology as a petrifact, something that has dried up, is dead, and is not working. And mythology is something that is working. You, when the mythology is alive, you don't have to tell anybody what it means. It's like looking at a picture that's really talking to you. It gets to you. And if you have to ask the artist, what does that mean? If he wants to insult you, he'll tell you. The myth must work like a picture. And it can be explicated, yes, if you've already got it, interpreted, amplified, and so forth. But it must work, and we've lost it. I was given by some of my friends a magazine article from a prestigious sociological journal called Foreign Affairs. This is their 60th anniversary. I was shocked to realize that because I subscribed to the first edition. In it is an article called The Care and Repair of Public Myth, where the author says that a society that does not have a myth to support and give it coherence goes into dissolution. And that's what's happening to us. He defines myth in an incomplete way. He defines it as an order of acceptable ideas concerning the cosmos and its parts and nations and other human groups. But it concerns also the mystic dimension that informs all this. And if that's not there, you don't have a mythology, you have an ideology. It concerns also the pedagogy of the individual, giving him a guiding track to guide him along. And that's what the myth that I've just given you does. It coordinates the living person with the cycle of his own life, with the environment in which he's living, and with the society, which itself has already been integrated in the environment.
As the sand and pollen paintings reveal, the landscape of the American Indian was alive with meaning. The hills, the trees, and animals, all part of the sacred covenant between the Indian and the natural world. For the most part, the Indian way of life has disappeared, supplanted by a European culture whose mythology speaks a completely different symbolic language. Chief Seattle tells us, the bear, the deer, the great eagle are our brothers. Yet Genesis gives us dominion over all the earth. The conquest of America has long been complete, manifest destiny, an historical footnote. But what of the mythology brought to this new land? Is it alive? Does it, in Campbell's words, speak to us like a picture?
I think what happened in our mythology is that the symbols, the mythological archetypal symbols, became interpreted as facts. Jesus was born of a virgin. Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Jesus did go to heaven by ascension. And we know that these things did not happen. And so the mythic forms are called falsehoods. And so the word myth now means falsehood. And so we've lost the symbols. Meanwhile, we need the symbols. And they come up in disturbed dreams and nightmares and so forth, which are dealt with by the psychiatrists. It was with Freud and Jung and Adler that it was realized, and particularly through Jung, that the figures of dream are really figures of personal mythologization. You're creating your own imagery related to the archetypes. But the culture has rejected them. The culture has gone into an economic and political phase where the spiritual principles are completely disregarded. You may have practical ethics and that kind of thing, but there is no spirituality in any aspect of our contemporary Western civilization. The religious life is ethical. It is not mystical. That is gone. And the society is disintegrating, consequently. It is. The question is, will there ever be a recovery of the mythological, mystical realization of the miracle of life of which our society is a manifestation? And all of us, as we read in Chief Seattle's speech, brothers and sisters in the spirit of this all-informing mythos. It's just a fact, that's all. I think it starts with the Old Testament. I think with the Old Testament, God is a fact, not a symbol. And the Holy Land is that place and no other. And man is superior to the beasts. And nature is fallen. With the fall in the Garden of Eden, nature is corrupt. So we do not give ourselves to nature, as Chief Seattle did. We will correct nature. There is good and evil in nature. And we are supposed to be on the side of the good. So there is a tension here. You don't yield to nature. And a term of rejection and abuse is the idea, is caught in the idea of nature religions. These are nature worshippers. Well, what else do you have you got to worship? Some figment of your imagination that you've put up in the clouds? This is a strange thing that's happened. And then if you don't believe in that figure, then you don't have any worship. It's all gone. Blown. And when we had in the Puritan period the rejection of the whole iconography of the Christian myth and of the rituals by which it was given, delivered to your soul, and the whole thing rendered simply as a rational performance of people of goodwill together, particularly those in that particular church, you've lost the whole thing. It's just been torn apart bit by bit. Now, what do we read in the newspapers? We're reading murders, rapes, politicians, and athletes. That's it. And that's the reading that people used to devote to worship legends of the deities who represent the founding figures of their life, religion, and so forth. It's been a total secularization. And people are hunting around. Some of them know that they're hunting and others don't.